The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
But first, the Department of Health announced last night that 10 more people have died from COVID-19 in Ireland and 200 new cases have been diagnosed. There are now 2,615 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the Republic. The latest figures also show there are 17 clusters of people with COVID-19 in nursing homes. The Taoiseach declared on Friday night that everyone must stay at home except in specific circumstances until April the 12th. Infectious disease specialist with the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, Professor Sam McConkie, is on the line. Professor Sam McConkie, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of the latest figures? We were supposed to be at a much higher total, according to the early modelling. We have not reached that total. Is that simply because we're not testing enough to find that total?
So the last question's a difficult one, but at the first one's, I completely agree with you that our rate of increase has definitely slowed. In fact, when we look over the last 5 days, things seem to be a very similar number of new cases each day. So we are seeing a slowing down in the number of confirmed cases, and that's something to be happy about and celebrated. So the next question then is, why is that? And of course, it could be that the COVID-19 spread is slowing down because of the restrictions that have started on the 12th of March initially, and then the 16th of March, and then new ones on Friday. Or, as you've just said and alluded to, it could also be that our ability to test and detected either through lack of swabs, lack of staff, lack of laboratory equipment or lack of decontamination equipment is slowing down the number of confirmed cases. So it's difficult just with the crude figures to distinguish those two. There are some ways you can do that by looking at the total number of tests done each day and seeing the positivity rate on a daily basis. That can give you some idea if it's a running out of tests or if it's the actual improvement. But I'm hopeful that things, and I think one of the messages from this is that things do seem to be, what would you say, disimproving at a slower rate than they were disimproving two weeks ago. And I think we should take some heart from that. A lot of us are a bit tired, cooked up in our houses, and I think it is important to see that it looks like there's some good signs. If you were to turn around the other path and say, what should the figures look like if they were having some positive effect? This is what they should look like at this point. So I'm a bit heartened by them, frankly.
Now, the modelling that has been done, worst-case scenario, by mid-April, a demand for 546 ICU beds a day. Yeah. Now, trying to understand that, is that people arriving, looking for an ICU bed on that day, that there'll be 500 plus every single day, worst case scenario, or is it that the total demand for ICU beds will be a total of 546, some people leaving ICU, some people arriving at ICU, or is it new cases every day?
Unfortunately, it's potentially new cases every day in a worst-case scenario. If the thing continues in the next couple of weeks as it has been in the last 5 days, then hopefully we won't get there. But we don't have 500 spaces for new patients every day in ICU. And this infection messes up one's lungs for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. It's not a sort of 2 days in ICU, quick ventilate and then out, like you would with ordinary pneumonia, which, we've been doing for years. People get streptococcus pneumonia, sort of conventional old pneumonia, if you like to call it that, and get very sick. 2 days in a ventilator and people get better, and then they're back to the wards again. Unfortunately, this pathogen seems to require 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or even longer on a ventilator before people get better. So it's a very prolonged time using that resource. So you're quite right that our ventilator capacity could easily be maxed out. That's why we can never meet that demand. We can never change our hospital system to meet the demand for ventilators in a worst-case scenario. So my view is we should listen to the Taoiseach, listen to Dr. Tony Hunahan, stay inside and prevent the virus spreading among us through physical distancing.
I mean, a lot of this understanding is down to pure mathematics, pure sums, arithmetic, really. And if you look at Governor Cuomo in New York saying they need 30,000 ventilators for, 8 million people, you do the math and you say, well, for 5 million people here, we're going to need something like 20,000 ventilators.
That's if it spreads as badly in Ireland as it does in New York. New York is very densely populated. It's multi-stories, and they were much slower. You probably know the political leaders in the US were quite much in denial about this. When we cancelled St. Patrick's Day and had closing schools, they really hadn't done hardly anything. So by starting early and by having an earlier response, I'm hoping we won't see the huge outbreak in Ireland that we see in Italy or in New York. So I hope that by having these early radical measures, 12th of March, closing schools, closing colleges, closing creches, and then, you know, closing pubs, closing St. Patrick's Day, and then all the other restrictions, we have in fairness been in before the Americans in instituting rigorous control measures. So unfortunately, I think they're suffering from lack of early action. And so that's where he's at. He's at a different epidemic than we're at. And unfortunately, the Italians are in that situation as well. They were testing people who travelled from China and Wuhan very thoroughly, but they hadn't really tested the sick people with chest infections and pneumonia in northern Italy. And then it suddenly became a huge thing.
It's one of the worrying things. We have obviously open borders at the moment. There are flights coming in. Yesterday, a flight from New York with 150 people on board. You'd like to think that they would all be bussed off to some place of containment for 2 weeks because they're coming from a hot spot. I don't think that happened.
I think there's advice from the government that they self-isolate. So there is an advisory that people coming in have 14 days of self-isolation. You're quite right. Should we be considering some more, what would you say, enforced quarantine? We did this when there were two Irish folk came from Wuhan. They came with about 120 people from the UK and were accommodated in a quarantine centre on the Wirral near Liverpool about 2 months ago, as you probably remember, and then only after 14 days when they were clear were they able to walk the streets of Europe again. So that's what we're doing in Wuhan. Turns out Wuhan's now probably the safest place in the world you could come from. It stopped circulating in China, and the only cases they're getting now in China are people who've got it elsewhere and are travelling into China, like you've just described. So I think we should take seriously this idea of some quarantine, more or less enforced quarantine of one sort or another for 2 weeks. That's a very radical decision. Pat, even just talking about the proposal to stop, you know, Irish citizens, Irish passport holders landing and freely moving around their old country is a really radical restriction on our liberties, in my view. And that's why, as you know, I've been saying really we need some high-level cross-party political decision-making and discussions and open, transparent, free discussions about that sort of radical restriction before we get there. I think that could happen over 2 or 3 days. I think if you've a rapid sort of subcommittee structure has served us well in the past for controversial topics, but I feel open discussion and cross-party agreement on that sort of radical measures would be helpful before it's implemented. But I certainly think we should be discussing it as we are. I think it's the right discussion. Closing the borders completely, Pat, is a daft idea for the following reason. We export a lot of pharmaceuticals that other people need, and we import, as we all discovered yesterday, most of our personal protective equipment from China and Wuhan, and we would need to continue to import that PPE, otherwise our health sector won't function without PPE. Similarly, a lot of medications.
We're not actually talking about cargo. I mean, pilots go, they pick up the cargo, they bring it back, and it's unloaded and so on. We're talking about people, living, breathing people who may have COVID-19, who are then living and breathing on other people and giving it to them. That's what we're concerned about. So you'd wonder why. And I mean, America's our friend, et cetera, et cetera. Loads of Irish people in New York particularly. But if you were told a plane full of Italians was coming from Milan, 150 Italians, would you allow them in?
I think that needs to be a national decision. I don't feel it's helpful for me to prognosticate one way or the other on that. I think what we need is a national, unified government agreed decision on that. And regardless of whether Italians or Irish passport holders, both subgroups we could consider, I think we need a national, unified, single agreement on that. And then we all need to row in behind the agreed decision. But I do think that's certainly on the table. I think we should be discussing it.
Yeah, at least talking about it.
Exactly.
The question of cocooning, do you think this is the appropriate way to go? Because people are a little bit confused. I mean, if you have, say, an elderly gentleman or woman who has a dog and they're supposed to be cocooning, but they can quite safely take the dog for a ramble down the country, Boreen, without meeting a soul. I mean, is that okay?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that is fine. And the rural Ireland is very sparsely populated, and people don't hardly meet the travellers. The elderly also, even though we use the word social isolation, but social isolation is sort of something you suffer from rather than something you want. And what we want, I suppose, is more physical isolation. Now, I did use the word social isolation a lot at the beginning because I wanted to get across the idea that it was all of society has to do it. It's not just Sam or you, Pat, doing physical isolation. It's everyone needs to do it. Our whole of society needs to be physically distancing. So that's why I did use the word quite a lot, social distancing, but it was sort of all of society doing, practicing physical distancing. But I think we have to find ways of exercising and ways of maintaining our sanity and happiness through all this. And if that involves a little bit of exercise down a boreen, you know, as long as you're 2 meters from the neighbours, that's probably fine.
The question of exercise, I saw a post yesterday online, people boasting that they'd done an 80k cycle. That's hardly what the Taoiseach was talking about.
Well, you have to put limits on things. It's like a speed limit, and you could say, is 29 kilometres an hour really any more safe than 31 kilometres an hour in a driving zone? But so there is a limit of 30 kilometres an hour in some parts of our cities. So you have to have a limit, and our Taoiseach has decided it's 2 kilometres. And my view is we should respect the legal limits that our government have put on us. As one wag said around where I live, you could go 2 kilometres away from your home and then go around the circumference of a circle multiple times, so you're never more than 2k from your house, but it's about 12.5 kilometres in the circumference. So I think there are people trying to find ways of doing their exercise, and physical exercise is important. The more steps you do per day, the longer you live, so getting your 8,000 steps in or 10,000 steps is definitely a good thing for you. And I think we should follow the rules. I think this is a time for national unity and for coming together and following the rules rather than trying to find the little chinks in them.
Yeah. And last night in my area here in Dalkey, reports of a house party, young people seen walking up Castle Park Road with cans in their hands. Okay. The message certainly not getting through to them.
I mean, I don't know where they've been living, because obviously they must have heard that Leo closed the pubs. I'm sure that didn't, they realised he didn't do that lightly, so trying to sort of subvert that, but I mean, that's a bit of human nature. But the question then is, how should we police this? How should we enforce this? How should we as a society try and dissuade folk from doing that? Because inevitably those young people probably live with others when they're finished the party, and then maybe transmitting the virus to others. So it is we're all in this together. I think it's worth saying that, I mean, there are real risks for this social distancing. Things like people being cooked up together. In some countries, it's been shown that there's higher rates of domestic abuse and violence. And for some people who are victims of violence in the home, if everyone's cooked up in the home, it's very hard to seek help. It's harder to get out. It's harder to make your plight known to others, including children who are victims of violence in the home. It's harder for their parent maybe to get them to a place of safety at this time. So I do feel there are very significant downsides of this self-isolation and physical distancing we're doing. So that's a very, very big tragedy for a significant number of people.
Now, the things we are doing, yeah?
Well, is Northern Ireland, the border. I grew up in Clonus, which is right on the border between Monaghan and Fermanagh. And as you probably know, the British tried to close the border in the 1960s by blowing huge holes in the road. And there's about 400 miles of border, and it's indented and nearly impossible to close. So I do feel, having grown up right on the border, we need a unified cross-border All-Ireland approach this with the good folk in Northern Ireland. Now, they haven't been struck with quite as bad a numbers as we have yet, but
they're not testing as much as we are either.
That's correct.
They're not testing as much as we are. And you think back to foot and mouth and what we did there in terms of animal movements and so on. And sometimes you wonder if we're more concerned about animal welfare and things like equine flu than we are about human conditions, but that's maybe for another day. Sam, in terms of what we are doing, we got all that gear from China, the beginnings of a rather large supply, so hopefully PPE will not be an issue for our medical people. We're opening City West as an isolation place, but also a step-down place to take people out of hospitals where those hospitals might be needed for COVID-19. So there are some things we're doing right, but I've been told that we require 5.5 nurses to cover every ICU bed, and that's, you know, for 24/7 cover. Is personnel shortage going to be what will do for us?
Almost certainly we'll run out of staff before the actual physical beds, because it's possible in a big hospital to, if you've to convert other wards into ventilated wards, and even the operating room ventilators could be used to help someone like it converted to an intensive care. So essentially the recovery room where you recover from your anaesthetic could be used as an intensive care, and the machines that are used to help you breathe when you're asleep during the operation could be used to ventilate sick people. So it actually becomes an intensive care. So I tend to agree with you that the staff, as many people have celebrated, the healthcare staff could be a limiting factor, especially physiotherapists and nurses. Maybe possible in some countries for one nurse to look after two or three patients on a ventilator together. That would not be the standard of practice in Ireland, where there's generally one-to-one nursing in ICU. But you're quite right, because of holidays and shifts and 38-hour shift to cover 168 hours in the week, you do need 5.5 nurses. So the staff are our most precious asset here, and staff will get exhausted and get burned out and get tired, and as we know, some will unfortunately get COVID-19. So I think staff is a main challenge, and also things like oxygen and some of the supplies we need.
Now, some of the questions coming in. Please ask Sam, when will an antibody antigen test be available for us to check if we have had it? We feel that our entire household has had it. Very sick house for 2 weeks. We are asthmatic and we'd like to know that we have beaten it. That's from Claire. Now, that's a very important thing, because if there is a test that says, yes, you've had it, and you're not likely to get it again this time round, although you might next year on the next global circulation of COVID, it might have varied somewhat. But if you've had it and you're recovered, get into the community and do some vital work. People would love to know whether they've had it or not.
So there are many companies developing antibody tests that will hopefully give us an idea serologically if somebody's been exposed and had COVID-19 or not. And I'm seeing several prototypes of those coming through. Now, the ones I've seen haven't passed sort of my standard of quality. They still need a bit more validation before I'd actually believe the results. And just because you've got antibody there doesn't mean that you're protected. I give you an example. For tuberculosis, people do develop antibodies that show they've got some TB, but those antibodies are not protective, so you can still catch TB again. Similarly, for HIV infection, people with HIV show HIV antibodies, but those antibodies are not protective against reinfection from HIV. So there's some antibodies are what are called non-neutralizing, and they're there and they recognize the virus and they tell you, yes, this person's had that virus before, but they don't actually protect effectively against another infection. So those are two different concepts that you have to separate out. One is getting an antibody test, which your listener quite reasonably asked for, and that I'm pretty sure will happen. But then the second thing is, do those antibodies consistently, reliably protect, even for a period of a year or two, against getting COVID-19 again? Yeah. And we don't know that, and the two are two separate questions. For other coronaviruses, the immune response is partial, not complete, and it's temporary. It lasts 2 or 3 years. So we don't know yet with any confidence whether the immune system will protect humans from repeated COVID-19 exposure. My view is that's an unknown parameter at this point.
Another one. My brother came home from the States on Thursday on a BA flight via the UK. He said the flight was packed cheek to jowl and no one mentioned anything about anything to him. He is here with us now and hopes to go back home in 2 weeks. I mean, that's a big issue. Now, we've talked about airline safety, and the air on board the flight qualifies almost to operating theatre standards of filtration.
Yeah.
So that may not be the issue. But still, sitting beside someone who's contaminated in some way, touching the table, going to the toilet that somebody has used, they're the issues.
Well, it's not even just the flight, but even the fact that he was in the US. There's a huge outbreak of COVID-19 in the US where he was living for the previous 2 weeks. So you could easily have acquired it while circulating in the US and even possibly in the airport in the UK. So I agree with you that airplanes are perhaps, people worry too much about what you catch in the airplane. It's relatively safe as things go, but it's what he could have caught in the US before he left there. That's an issue. So, I mean, advice to that man is that maybe he should be seriously considering 2 weeks of self-isolation, fairly strictly, essentially self-enforced quarantine for 2 weeks, which does make you wonder then what's the point in travelling if you're going to spend your time in Ireland in isolation. Yeah. So I think that's the sort of question we were talking about earlier, and I do think that's a big question.
Yeah. Another one here. Would you please put it out there that we have to close our borders to non-essential travel now? We should have done it last week. It won't be too long before we've people travelling here for treatment when their own countries can't treat them. Please, this self-isolation thing is a joke. That's from Chris. I mean, there is that possibility if the UK, because they were so tardy in acting, end up with an overwhelmed system, that people might try to make their way to another country, i.e. this one, to get treatment because the NHS can't cope.
Yeah, I mean, we've historically been very open and welcoming to people, whatever reason they come for in our country. So I hope we can continue our old traditions of hospitality, Pat. On the other hand, if people are sort of taking you for a ride and, you know, not paying for it, that's a different issue. So I think this is again where I was talking about we need a national discussion about these issues and then some national cohesive unified response that we're all willing to row in behind. What I mentioned earlier, we do need to think about these issues, but my view is it's not a willy-nilly debate we need about it and a willy-nilly variable response. It's a cohesive national united response to how do it, especially with Northern Ireland. It's very important because, as I said, we are on the same island with them, and closing that border is almost physically impossible for many, many reasons. There's, again, a lot of trade. I know you want to keep the goods flowing and the people not flowing, but I'm just thinking of all the milk lorries and butter lorries crossing the border from Monaghan into Fermanagh and Derry and Armagh, and the driver has to cross with those milk lorries, you know. So it's not that easy to separate out the goods from the people because the two often go together. So closing borders is a problem. Milk is important. That's what will feed us. You know, we produce a lot of food in Ireland. Food security is essential. So crippling the milk industry isn't a sensible proposal either. So that's where I think there's a lot of nuances and a lot of thinking and needs to be done around that. So that's where I would propose, again, 10 now, of our elected representatives to discuss it.
Sam, I'll read this out, but I don't expect you to give romantic advice. Keith in Waterford. I'm an Irish citizen. My wife is a Japanese citizen. We got married in Japan and I travelled back to Ireland ahead of her. Now she's stuck in Japan. I'm stuck in Ireland, and it looks like we won't see each other for months. Can you give us any advice? We're supposed to be on honeymoon together right now, but we're stranded on different continents. So that's for poor Keith in Waterford. Well, absence does make the heart go fonder.
Yeah. Skype.
Keith. Skype, FaceTime, all of those things, yeah. The only solution. Now, this is, again, these are personal problems, but they do typify the whole, if you like, and the generality of difficulties people are having. I understand and support the need for restrictions to slow down the spread of COVID-19. However, I feel the restrictions brought in on Friday are too broad and what has been deemed essential construction workers too narrow, causing unintended consequences. My wife, who's almost 8 months pregnant, my three-year-old daughter and I moved out of our apartment, which we sold last week, and we're due to complete a purchase and move into a new build house this coming week. There are minor things to be completed in the house, which could have been completed with one person working at a time, meaning no risk to anyone. However, these restrictions mean it can't be completed and leaves us homeless and relying on friends to have somewhere to stay. This is very stressful with a new baby coming in 5 weeks and nowhere to live. Surely situations like this where people are relying on completing purchases in order to avoid homelessness could have been accommodated in essential construction and services. I realise it isn't the biggest problem anyone is facing at the moment, but it's causing a lot of stress for us and in particular for my pregnant wife, not knowing if we'll have anywhere to live when the baby comes. I don't know what can be gained by sending this email, but I feel the need to highlight this as we are at a loss as to what to do and worried about what the near future holds for us. That's from Greg in Dublin. Yeah. So, what do you do? I mean, it is a two-week delay. After 2 weeks, Easter Sunday, who knows, there might be more delays, and the baby will still come.
But it may be that single person's working alone on a building site. If a single builder, as your caller suggests, is doing that as a day's work, you know that's relatively safe. If they're physically well and working completely alone, then that's not such a big risk. So I think that's again where, as time goes on, we're probably going to have to find ways of kind of living our life and doing the things that need to be done despite good restrictions that prevent COVID-19 circulating. So I hope over time we get more nuanced and less kind of sort of invasive restrictions, but yet still find what are more effective but less impact on our daily lives. So that will be the learning project. It's a huge amount to learn about, you know, which of these are more important, which less important, and how can we modify these and tweak them and tailor them to make them less invasive in the situation that you've just described.
And the final question is about people who feel they've had the virus. They've felt like, you know, death for a few days, and they suspect it was COVID-19, but they soldiered through at home, minding themselves, drinking lots of water, taking paracetamol, trying to breathe easily and finding it difficult. But eventually, after 3, 4, 5 days, they're through it. What should they do?
I would caution against making the conclusion that they had COVID-19. Obviously, I'm a frontline doctor seeing lots of patients, and people come in like that, and we swab them for various different viruses, and quite a significant number turn out to have influenza A or influenza B or H1N1 influenza. So those exact symptoms that you've just described can also be like the flu. And just because people haven't had the bad flu like that before doesn't mean they haven't got the bad flu now. So just because somebody thinks they've had COVID-19 doesn't mean they have had COVID-19. It just means they think they've had it, if you like. So the flu, unfortunately, can present with very, very similar fever, cough, and headache, and bone aches, and so on. So that's where the antigen or antibody test, that particularly the antibody test that a previous caller talked about, would be really helpful to see did they have COVID-19 in retrospect. So I think once they're feeling better, 14 days after symptoms are started, then you can just get back to normal. So there's a sort of a 14-day period where we're worried that people may be infectious. So if you start counting from the first day of symptoms, and then once people have done their 14 days and are feeling fine, and I think it's you have to be 5 days without fever, the criteria that have been used, but then you can just get back to normal life, whatever normal is in the new world.
All right, on that note, Professor Sam McConkie of the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, thank you very much for joining us. A very informative conversation. Well, next...